南無妙法蓮華経。
南無
妙
法蓮華経。
Not supposed to chant it. That was the first thing I ever saw Sangharakshita say. Which is quite strange, because it doesn't come from our tradition at all. It comes from Soka Gakkai International, who are a different Buddhist tradition. So the first time I ever met Sangharakshita was June 2008, and it was at a Network of Buddhist Organisations event at the SGI HQ, which is over in Taplow and Reading, in this marvellous country mansion with acres of ground, a restaurant that feeds 300 or 400, lovely place. And there were talks by a symposium of speakers, people like Stephen Batchelor, and Sangharakshita, the founder of our tradition, was there. And I hadn't seen him before, and I remember watching this. He was 83 at the time, and I remember watching him walk with support towards the stage. And he had some difficult health problems at the time, and he was quite unsteady on his feet. And then he stood up, looked at the audience, and just belted out that mantra, just like that. And it was just like, whoa, and the whole audience just turned heads, because it was just totally unexpected. But what really struck me afterwards was how skillful that was, because he was just rejoicing in the fact that this was a different Buddhist tradition that was hosting the event. But, you know, he started by just sort of paying homage to their tradition, to kind of chanting that mantra. And I must admit, I didn't even know what the mantra meant. I had to look it up last night, because I couldn't remember what it meant. So it literally means, I dedicate my life to the wonderful law of cause and effect that leads to Buddhahood. Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. So I'm aware of the mantra, but it's not something that we do in our tradition. But it was such a skillful way just to introduce himself and to respond as well. I mean, Stephen Batchelor had been quite blunt with some of his views, and you know, the whole thing was about the development of Buddhism in the UK. And I remember there were lots of sharp questions poised at Sangharakshita, but the way that he answered was so skillful. It was so imbibed with the Dharma. It was as if every response that he gave was a response, and by the way, here's a bit of Dharma teaching on the back of it. And I was there with a couple of friends who some of you know, Matt and Roland. And it was lovely just to sort of meet Sangharakshita, have my introduction to Sangharakshita in that kind of setting, really. But it made a real impression. Just the first words I ever heard him say was a chant from an 83-year-old that really just silenced the entire room. So it was just a great kind of introduction, really. And I don't really remember too much about what he said, but it was more about how he said it, the calm authority, and that when he spoke, everyone in the room paid attention. There must have been 60, 70 people in the room, and everyone just paid attention when he spoke. There was this authority. It was how he said it. He didn't have any notes. And like I said, he didn't just respond to the previous speaker. Whatever he said carried this dharmic weight. It conveyed a depth and a clarity of meaning, and it beautifully expressed the points of Dharma that he wove into his talk. So yeah, it made a real deep impression. I think at that time I'd been coming to this centre for about just over a year and a half, and that was the first opportunity that I'd had to come into contact with Sangharakshita. So the next time that I met Sangharakshita, our going for refuge group, so when you ask for ordination in our tradition, you can join what's called a going for refuge group, so with a bunch of other folks who have also asked for ordination, and you come together and meet regularly and discuss life, what you're up to, where you're going, difficulties, practice, you study together and so on. So our going for refuge group had arranged to go and meet Sangharakshita en masse, so we squeezed the six of us into a car, which was an interesting 3-hour journey to Birmingham, to go up and meet Sangharakshita. And this was September 2009, I think. And I remember when we got there and we parked up and we were about 20 minutes early. And we were standing outside like a bunch of nervous schoolboys. And I've never smoked in my life, but I felt then like having a cigarette. I was just like so nervous. And we were all just kind of standing there. Well, you go and knock at the door. No, I don't want to knock at the door. You go and knock at the door. And it was really strange. You know, most of us had been around the movement then for 3-4 years, a couple of the guys for like 10 or 15 years. But yet we were all really nervous the first time that we were meeting Sangharakshita. And we were aware of this, but we had no idea why we were nervous. We were outside the front door talking, why are we so nervous? We're just going to go and have a chat and a cup of tea. Yet we were really nervous. It was very strange. And Sangharakshita clocked that straight away. So as soon as we sat down in the dining area around a table with him, one of the community there brought out a freshly baked cake. And Sangharakshita took a mouthful before he even spoke to us and said, this cake tastes like pudding. And it just totally broke the ice. You know, it just totally relaxed us. So it was almost as if he sensed that, yeah, these chaps are a bit nervous, let's kind of break the ice and just get them to communicate. So it was really nice that he did that in such a gentle way, and that we all then just felt able to kind of just ask questions. And we hadn't really prepared any questions, but we talked a bit in the car on the way up about some things that we wanted to ask him about his life, about Tri Ratna, that's our movement. And then afterwards, in our Going for Refuge group the following week, we actually made notes of that kind of meeting with him. So I've got some of those notes here, just to kind of share with you more detail around what that sort of 90 minutes, 2 hours was like with Sangharakshita. He was very generous with his time. Again, he wasn't in the best of health, but he spent the best part of 90 minutes or more with us, just answering a barrage of weird and wacky questions from a bunch of nervous blokes. One of the first things that we discussed was vegetarianism. I was vegetarian way before I got involved with the movement. To me, it's never been an issue, and I've been vegan now for a number of years. But some people do struggle with vegetarianism, and Sangharakshita told us the story that he became a vegetarian overnight. So he was in Singapore, and he was travelling with a couple, a man and a woman, who were fanatical about vegetarianism. And apparently they'd later opened a vegetarian restaurant, which back in those days was unheard of. And the woman of the couple said to him, so you're a Buddhist, how come you're not a vegetarian? And Sangharakshita said that he reflected on this overnight and became a vegetarian the very next day. And he's now been vegetarian for the best part of 70 years. And again, that really struck us. You know, he was someone who had been a committed Buddhist for a number of years, and he'd obviously thought deeply about vegetarianism, yet he was really struck by the depth of this conversation. And then he actually said to us that he was up most of the night reflecting on it, reflecting on, am I being skillful by still eating meat or eating fish? So the very next day he said, that's it. Overnight, become a vegetarian. For me, it was kind of like phasing myself off of red meat to white meat to no meat. I felt a kind of natural, kind of ethical, gradual decline of meat eating that way. And it's just like my ethics were getting sharper and sharper each time. But Sangharakshita just would say go cold turkey, but that's not really appropriate for becoming a vegetarian. So that really struck us all. And I think we all were and still are, at least vegetarian, if not vegan anyway. There's six of us that went. But that really struck us. One of the other things that we discussed was how to meet as a Going for Refuge group. And so once you're ordained in our tradition, we have things called chapters. And I remember him saying that a Going for Refuge group, and he always liked to use the word Going for Refuge, not GFR. You say the whole thing, it has more meaning. When you say GFR, you're taking away some of the meaning of what you're doing. Going for Refuge expresses the act that you're doing, and he was very clear on that to us. You always use Going for Refuge. And we asked him, well, is there anything that we should or shouldn't be doing in a Going for Refuge group, or a proto-chapter, as he also called it. And he gave us a few tips, and we were quite an organised Going for Refuge group, so we had like a kind of monthly schedule that we drew up of what we were doing and who was leading it and stuff like that. Quite weird for guys to be so organised. And the things that he suggested were do the refuges and precepts. So we started the morning with the refuges and precepts. So do confession, which we all found really hard. And I still find it hard in chapter. We perhaps don't do it as often as we should. Do we do it?
No.
He also said, spend some time chanting the Vajrasattva mantra, which is a beautiful mantra. It's a 108-syllable mantra. It's about purification. It's about looking at your karmic impact and trying to purify some of the impact where you've made mistakes. He said, take time to report in, meditate together, puja together, do transference of merits. So that's the last bit of a puja. Puja literally means devotional attention, or worship is a poor translation. So the transference of merits is the last section of the puja where you say, whatever good stuff I have done, may this be shared to all beings. So he said, do that. And you know, it's still something that we do when we do study. We tend to do a transference of merits at the end of study. He also highlighted that it's really important to meet regularly. And something that blew us all away, and yet it was so simple, was he said, if anyone's absent, take the time to find out why. See if they're all right. Don't just assume they're all right. Actually take the time to find out why. And that just really struck us all. And you think, well, of course you would, but it didn't occur to any of us that that's what we would do. And if someone didn't turn up, we just think, oh, they must have been busy. Maybe it's a bloke thing. I think my wife would say it's definitely a bloke thing, but it was just such a grounded piece of advice. One of the guys asked him, so what's the most important thing that we as mitras can do? So when you make more of a commitment in your Buddhist life, in our tradition, you can become a mitra, which literally means friend. So, and we're all mitras, you know, I'm going for a refuge group. It's kind of a prerequisite. And we asked him, what's the most important thing mitras can do to support a local centre? And again, his advice was, you know, I kind of thought he'd come up with some organisational suggestions or fundraising and stuff. And all he said was, be kind and welcoming. That's all he said. Welcome newcomers to the centre is the most important thing. Not about money, not about organisational stuff. Just be kind and welcome people. Be human. Somehow we got onto the topic of talking about Buddhafield, which is we have a part of our organisation where we do these weird, wacky outdoor events, and you can go and do stuff in hot tubs and play instruments and meditate together in fields and do that. And he was recounting a time many years ago when he was on his way to Buddhafield and it had been pouring with rain for 2 days. And he got there and the sun came out and it was wonderful. And the moment he left, the heavens opened and it rained again. And as he said this, he had this massive smile on his face. And again, it was, I think, part of his skillfulness in helping us all to relax. But it just kind of really struck us that, you know, he was able to kind of communicate in that way. We also got talking a bit about ordination, because we'd all asked for ordination at that time. And he's one of the things he said to us that, ordination is just the start. You know, so there's a number of us here today that are ordained. And he said, ordination is just the start. All the members should realise that they need to make a continued effort to make spiritual progress. He said it's essential to make progress. And he said part of that making progress is the vertical and horizontal friendships. He says they're essential because they help you track your progress. If you've got friends who are perhaps a bit more developed than you are, friends who are at the same level, friends who you are helping, he says by having constant contact with these people, they can help you realise where you are. Your friends can help you realise where you are as you help them. So again, a very simple piece of advice, but something that I know I certainly still try to put that into practice. And something that I'll talk a bit more about later, but Sangharakshita also wanted to get across to us, to the six of us, the use of Pali and Sanskrit. So when we chanted earlier on, we chanted in Pali, as I mentioned. And he said it's really important to have some contact with Pali or Sanskrit. And he really encouraged everyone to make some effort to understand the practices that we have in Sri Ratna and the usage, so why we have the refuges and precepts in Pali. And we kind of said, well, why? It's just a bunch of sort of old words, bit of mumbo jumbo, don't really understand it. And you know, he said, well, one of the important things, you know, the actual use of Pali transcends all the different Buddhist schools and traditions, and it brings us closer to the original Buddhist teaching. You know, the early Buddhist suttas, the scriptures, the texts, are written down in Pali, been translated lots of times since, but the originals are in Pali, and it brings us closer to the meaning. And you could ask three scholars to translate a Pali text and you would get quite distinct differences. I've done a bit of Pali translation, and I did the first bit of the Dhammapada, and my translation came out very different to Sangharakshita's, whose is very different to other translators as well. So when you translate from the Pali, there's lots of options. Lots of it is how you read, how you understand the text. And Sangharakshita's translation of the Dhammapada, one of the earliest Buddhist texts, brings out a certain liveliness, a certain strength, a real depth of connection with the world. So that particular point has really inspired me to look ever more closely at Pali. And the word Pali itself literally means text anyway. Other things we talked about, which I don't have very good notes on, we talked about shunyata, as you do. Buddhist word literally means, it's literally translated as emptiness. I don't actually remember what we talked about. I think it was Kelvin that said to him, so what's shunyata all about? And Sangha actually kind of looked at him and just said, stop trying to eliminate emptiness. Don't be afraid of it. And I think that was about all he said. And I still reflect on that today because I was reading through my notes of that and thought, oh, don't be afraid of it. We also talked at length, I think, about the importance of faith in spiritual practice, which I'll come on to a bit later. In that regard, Sangharakshita recounted that two of his teachers converted to Buddhism, so they weren't born Buddhists, Yogi Chen and Jagdish Kashyap. So they converted to Buddhism, and they were a real inspiration to him, he said, because they continued to strive on as they went through from one different teaching to another before they really found Buddhism. They realised that they hadn't found yet what was right for them in their spiritual practice. They kept on pushing until they discovered Buddhism. And I really inspired Sangharakshita to see these, you know, these two senior teachers who just kept on looking, kept on persevering, and then they found Buddhism, and that was it. That was all they needed. So that was our kind of collective meeting with Sangharakshita. And I remember as we were driving home from Birmingham, and we had these lovely moments in the car, silence, when the six of us were just sitting there reflecting on what had been said, some of the stuff that we'd asked Sangharakshita. I think we went through about three pots of tea while we were with him as well. And we had to make a couple of toilet breaks on the hard shoulder, I think, to get us home. So. But it was a lovely meeting. It was a lovely kind of more intimate contact with Sangharakshita. The next time that I met Sangharakshita was shortly before I got ordained. So I got ordained nearly 4 years ago. Yeah, can't believe I forgot that. And again, it was in Birmingham. And there's a couple of epic bits to this story. So it had been snowing for days, and I got to Euston and the trains were totally not working. I waited about 2 hours for a train at Euston, and I was about to phone up the community in Birmingham and say, I can't get there. And suddenly this train got put on, and there was like this horde of animalistic tendencies that came out. Shoulders got broader, adrenaline got pumping, and this rush of people piled toward this train. And I remember standing in the corridor on this short train going up to Birmingham, thinking, what's this all about? What's going on? Why am I bothering? And we were getting near Coventry, so not too far from Birmingham, and suddenly, you know, it was snowing heavily, and the driver said, can't go any further, we're going to stop at Coventry. So train stopped at Coventry. They didn't bother putting on any buses or anything, just kicked us off the train and said, sort yourselves out. So the queue for taxis was, as you can imagine, quite epic. So we queued for, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes for a taxi, squeezed five strangers into a taxi to go into central Birmingham, and then we crawled through traffic in the snow, and I had my friend Google out in my pocket on my phone with the maps, thinking, okay, how far am I from Sangaratta? And we were going nowhere. I thought, okay, I'm just going to be even later. And I'd already called and said I was going to be late. And we were about 4 miles away from where Sangaratta was living at the time. And I just stopped the taxi, paid my share, and got out and walked. And I had on like full snow gear, this puffer jacket and walking boots and waterproof trousers and everything else. I remember walking this 4 miles across the outskirts of Birmingham in the snow. And I walked it in about 30 minutes or something. I was absolutely hacking it. And I got to the community, and I wasn't just sweating. Apparently it was a sight to be seen. And the community sort of dragged me in, undressed me in the hallway. They're all blokes, that's good. Undressed me in the hallway, just took all my clothes, because they were just soaking wet, gave me some clean clothes, and then took me up to see Sangaratta. And that was kind of the epic journey just to get there. And yeah, thank goodness for Google, because I wouldn't have found the way across Birmingham without that. And the first thing that Bhante Sangaratta said to me was, thank you. He just said, thanks for making the effort, because they told him I was coming up from London, stuck in the snow over the trains. And the first thing he did was come up to me and just put his hand on my shoulder and just say thank you. And that made the whole visit worthwhile. Just actually having that contact where he just said, human to human, thanks for coming to see me. And we talked a bit about my ordination, which was a few months away. And I hadn't had any kind of burning questions to ask him, any kind of big issues or whatever. It was more just an opportunity for one-on-one, just to talk more about his life, actually, just to kind of see, get more of a direct sense of what I was being ordained into, an order that he had founded. And we talked about, again, some of his teachers when he'd met other Buddhist scholars, such as John Blofeld in India and Kalimpong. And I got much more of a sense of the presence of who Sangaratta is. So it's a very simple meeting, yet it was very meaningful, and it kind of reaffirmed that this is the Buddhist order that I wanted, and still is the order that I want to be ordained into. And I was very glad that I'd arranged to stay that night with a friend in one of the men's communities just around the corner. But that meeting with Sangaratta had a real impact on me, and I remember being up half the night with this friend of mine who lives down Eastbourne now, got ordained a couple of years ago. And we're just up half the night just talking about this meeting with Sangaratta and about our lives and what we were doing. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful weekend. Train journey home was a shocker, but it was a very memorable weekend. So those were the occasions that I've personally had contact with Sangaratta, not many. He is still seeing people, as Taramani said last week. So the people do still have the opportunity to meet him at Adishtami. So I'm going to talk now a little about some of the aspects of Sangaratta's teachings that particularly affected or inspired me. And that's mainly through the medium of his books and through his talks. He's written a book or 60. He's given a talk or a couple of hundred, probably more. No one's actually counted, have they? That'd be interesting. Yeah, I'll do that. And I'm also going to reflect on one of the main aspects of Tree Ratna that continues to appeal and inspire me, and that's the piece that Tree Ratna is not just one Buddhist tradition. And what Sangaratta did was to put together this marvellous blend of Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. So it's this blend of these core Buddhist elements and put them all into this one kind of magnificent schema that gives us lots of opportunity to develop, to practice in different ways. We've got more tools in our Buddhist toolbox perhaps than any other Buddhist tradition. And I'll talk more about that in a bit. So Sangaratta realised that he was a Buddhist on reading the Diamond Sutra in 1942 when he was 17 years old. it took me until I was 38 to realise that for myself. But I've always been a bit of a slow starter. So, 17 or 38. And for me, you know, I had the equivalent of an electric shock to get on the path. So I woke up in the hospital partially paralysed. And they'd given me, I had to go in for a simple procedure, and they gave me the wrong anaesthetic, and I don't play nice with anaesthetics. And I woke up partially paralysed after the procedure. And when that effect wore off overnight, and they gave me something else to counteract it, that kind of really jolted me awake. And it was that incident that got me to walk through this door for the first time back in 2006. But just recalling that incident reminded me, that temporary paralysis, that reminded me of something that Sangharakshita wrote in Learning to Walk, which I looked up. So, thought, emotion and will were suspended. I carried out my duties and obeyed orders mechanically, without any mental reaction. It was as though the integrity of my inner being could be safeguarded only by means of a temporary paralysis. At the age of 19 in 1944, Sangharakshita was called up into the army, and he was stationed near Leatherhead. And that's something that he wrote about that time, just after he'd been called up. And clearly it was a different kind of a temporary paralysis to mine. But I remember when I first read that passage, not long after I'd been coming along, when I borrowed the book from the library here, I was really struck by the intensity of Sangharakshita's description. It almost was as if his life was at stake. He had to find a way to protect that which really matters, his inner being, as he described it. So one of the other books of Sangharakshita's that I read first, which made a massive impact on me, and it still does, is Yogi's Joy. This is probably a strange choice for some of you that may know the text. And the first couple of times that I read it, I made so many notes I couldn't read them, because they're all overlapping each other in the pages and pages, and trying to decipher that was a bit of a mission last night. I mean, what does that say? I write with both hands, and both hands I write equally badly. So trying to read it looks like a real mess. Anyway, but looking back at those notes really revealed what an impact that book had on me, even if I didn't understand and still don't understand everything that Sangharakshita was saying. And one key passage which I highlighted: ordination is essentially about going to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha for your refuge. It is about taking the Buddha and his teaching as your point of reference in everything you say, think and do. There's so much in that one sentence. You know, it talks about the three jewels: ethics, reflection, mindfulness, meditation, precepts, wisdom, just in that one sentence. And in the period immediately before, in the weeks immediately before I was ordained, that sentence became a kind of personal mantra. I had it with me when I went to work, I had it with me at home. And a mantra literally means protector of the mind. And it was almost as if that passage was kind of keeping me kind of safe in this important stage of my spiritual transformation, kind of giving me direction, reaffirming my purpose. What we are trying to do in all our practice, whether of ethics, ritual or meditation, is to refine consciousness. Enough said, really. Make back to the beginning your watchword. Keep going back to what you think you understand, what is so straightforward that you never think twice about it, and consider it, reflect on it. Note how it bears on your experience of life and practice as a Buddhist. Very often we do not realise the extent to which we understand, but do not practice. We think we understand a spiritual teaching because we can follow its logic. But to put it into practice day in and day out involves a very different kind of knowledge. And to me, that passage is a reminder for us to not keep simply pursuing what we perceive as ever higher teachings or the next best spiritual thing. It reminds us to regularly come back to basics, constantly re-examine our understanding, our motives in all of our life. And as Sangharakshita also reminds us in the Yogi's Joy, It is perhaps surprising how little we need to know in order to practice the Dharma and even to communicate it. And we can distill it down quite simply, quite succinctly. When Sangharakshita was asked to describe Buddhism for an interview that he did in one word, he was asked to describe Buddhism in one word, he just said impermanence. Good choice, I wouldn't have thought that. But yeah, impermanence. So without Sangharakshita, it's unlikely I would have come across the Dharma. I don't quite know what compelled me to a Buddhist centre after my hospital experience. I'd lived in Croydon for years and had no idea there was a Buddhist centre. But I ended up here after being in hospital. And if it hadn't been for Sangharakshita, this centre wouldn't be here. So I'm eternally grateful for what Sangharakshita did in 1967-68 in starting Tri Ratna. And to all those who stood on his shoulders and started up the many Tri Ratna centres that we now have around the world. But of course, especially for those who started up the centre here in Croydon. Because none of us would be here today without them. Not one of us. And as I touched on earlier, the fact that Tri Ratna is not solely based on any one tradition is really important to me. We can study suttas. And we can enjoy the marvellous madness of Mahayana texts, as I mentioned outside, like the Vimalakirti Nadesha. We can take part in devotional practices such as puja. And it's this depth, it's this breadth that I find continually appealing, refreshing and inspiring. In a sense, there is something for everyone, no matter what your preferences are. There are different parts available to each of us in our tradition that can really help you. And that can help you whether you're a devotional type, whether you prefer study, whether you prefer stepping into the realms of reading vast suttas with beautiful imagery. Or maybe like me, you're someone that takes inspiration from the combination of all these different parts. And I think for me it's this combination of elements that's really helped me to explore, to try to understand the changing rhythms of my life, to try and notice that every experience is precious. And it is so because experience is what we actually have. What's actually happening to us is all that we have from moment to moment. And we can follow our intuition, as I have done most of my life, using different practices, different techniques to respond to the highs and lows that we encounter. And we have a wonderful Sangha here in Croydon, and friends we can laugh, cry, study, meditate, confess with. Must do more confession, dear. They keep on talking about it, so we need to. So all this and a lot more that demonstrates Sangharakshita's creativity in the conception and development of what was the Western Buddhist Order and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, what we now call Tri Ratna. So coming into contact with Tri Ratna and with Sangharakshita and with others in the movement reawoke in me my love of poetry and words. When I was at school, I loved poetry. I hated school with a passion. Couldn't wait to leave. Left school with no qualifications except in English. Got A's in English because I loved it. Didn't like anything else. I love poetry, I love words. But I kind of fell out of that when I started work. And then coming into contact with Sangharakshita and his focus on poetry, with words, with the arts, really kind of lit that flame in me again. As it says in the 8th chapter of the Dhammapada, better than 1,000 meaningless words is one meaningful word that on hearing brings peace. So Sangharakshita inspired me to get back to reading poetry. Also to more fully investigate words, and that's something that I've done more and more from the Pali texts, reading the Pali text, translating the Pali text. Because to me that lends a greater context, it lends a greater meaning to the early Buddhist texts and the suttas. And it's also hard not to imagine now having Rilke and Eliot on my bedside locker. I read four core texts every week. I read Rilke every day almost. It sits on my bedside locker, just the poems of Rilke. I can't imagine not having that now. I go on solitary, I take one of those texts with me. However, I confess I've sometimes been frustrated with Sangharakshita's writing and the words he uses. One example was aching from the peregrinations of the day.
Could you say that again?
Aching from the peregrinations of the day. He could have just said travel. I had to look it up as well. The first time that I read The Survey, which is a very early book Sangharakshita wrote, I've never used an English dictionary so much in all my life. It's constant. And my copy of The Survey is a bit dog-eared, and there's pencilled notes in all the margins about some of the text, but lots about the English words that I had no idea what they meant. And when I reread my copy of The Survey now, it's only because I've got those notes, so I don't need to use a dictionary so much. So, yeah, peregrinations is my word for the day. So I touched on this earlier on. One of the things that Sangharakshita has written lots about, spoken lots about, is about something we call Shraddha in Sanskrit, or Sadha in Pali. Poorly translated as faith, because it's an easy word to say, but it's more a confidence, it's more a trust. In Buddhism, Shraddha is a verb, so it's something we do. It's active, it's not passive. And it's the confidence or trust that what we're doing is unquestionably right. And in the survey, Sangharakshita elucidates three aspects of faith, three aspects of confidence or trust in the Dharma. And these aspects are intuitive response. So we have an intuitive response to events that happen in our life. Rational investigation. So if we then look to rationally investigate what that response was, what that response relates to, how we responded, why we responded in that way. The last aspect is experiential verification. So we verify through our own experience our intuitive response. So again, very simple, but it's a teaching that I've come back to over and over again. Intuitive response, rational investigation, experiential verification. I think Arloka wrote a paper on that, or part of a paper on that one bit as well. So that's part of a confidence or trust that, to me, it's a simple word or a simple collection of words, Shraddha in itself. But if you break it down to those components, it really explores the meaning and so much more. There's so much more to it than just, oh, I've got trust in the Dharma. Well, what's your intuitive response? How do you investigate that response, and is it verified in your experience? But confidence doesn't mean certainty. For me, it's more the ability to take uncertainty in its stride. And blind faith doesn't work either. Genuine confidence requires a faith that's based on clear understanding, but a clear understanding that's grounded in our personal experience. Not anybody else's, our personal experience. That's the key. And that's acknowledging our experience just as it is, without throwing any concepts on top of it to try and alter the experience. Just noticing, acknowledging the raw experience. And there's a lovely passage from Padmasambhava which I'd like to share. So faith is like an inexhaustible treasure mine. It provides all needs and wants. Faith is like a man's hand. It gathers the roots of virtue. Faith is like a swift-footed steed. It carries you to the point of liberation. Faith is like an elephant who can carry a heavy load. It leads you higher and higher. Faith is like a sparkling fountainhead. It manifests spontaneous wakefulness. Once faith has dawned from deep within you, all virtuous qualities arrive in a mountainous heap. So Shraddha, this intuitive confidence or trust, continues to play a very important part in my life. Having the trust in my own intuition and the ability to explore that, examine that over and over again, and verify it through my own experience, it's very important. So looking more into words, words and their meaning. Well, Sangharakshita is very precise with words. One of the early books of his that I read had this phrase, the rectification of terms. make sure that if you use a term, you know why you're using it and what it is you're using, what does it mean? And it's kind of really encouraged me to look into words, explore their depth, the fullness of their meaning, but especially in Pali. And I tried to think of an example of one of the things that's really helped my practice. So I thought of the word dukkha. Dukkha. So dukkha is commonly translated as suffering, unsatisfactoriness. But like many Pali words, dukkha is really a compound that's made up of two words. Most of our order names are made up of multiple words in Pali or Sanskrit. Dukkha is the same, it's a compound. So dukkha is two words. So the kakh bit of dukkha, sounds quite Klingon to me, comes from the root akasha, which means space. And the duh of dukkha comes from the root, which kind of means the opposite of happiness. So it's a contrasted opposite, duh. You see it in lots of words in Pali. So it's a prefix that's used to imply badness or negativity. So an accurate, precise translation of dukkha is like unhappy space, messy space, bad space. And just looking at dukkha in that way, for me, has just given me more ways into it, a better way to examine it, rather than just thinking of it dukkha, suffering, unhappy or messy space, just speaks a lot more to me. When I see dukkha in Pali texts, used in other writings or talks, thinking of dukkha in that context has really helped me, rather than just thinking of it, oh, it's just suffering, it's just unsatisfactoriness. Well, actually, no, it's an unhappy space. And that space is obviously can contract and expand depending on our experience. Well, it's not fixed. And as an aside, you know, the Buddha asked, what is the origin of dukkha? He didn't ask, what is the cause of dukkha? And to me, that's always been an important distinction. What is the origin of dukkha? He didn't ask, what is the cause of dukkha? So why do we get into this unhappy space? Where does it come from? Where does it originate? And Glenn Wallace, who's written a great book called What's Dukkha, What Isn't? He says that our English term would have to have the following colourings on an increasing scale of intensity. Faint unsettledness, irritation, impatience, annoyance, frustration, disappointment, dissatisfaction, aggravation, tension, stress, anxiety, vexation, pain, desperation, sorrow, sadness, suffering, misery, agony, anguish. Heavy list. Unhappy space, much better. But just talking about words and how Sangharakshita has kind of bumped me back in to look at words and understand words more. Simple words that we all know intellectually, like compassion. And we all kind of know what compassion is. But to me, since becoming a Buddhist, since hearing the word in a much broader context, compassion has a lot more meaning and it has an active part in my life. So it's not just a word that, oh yeah, I know what that means. It means feeling a bit nicer and maybe helping people once in a while and stuff like that. It now plays an active part in my life since coming into contact with Buddhism, with Sri Ratna. But the way that I now see compassion, you know, it's a meaning for me that's born from my experience now, because I can live a more compassionate life. I have a better relationship with what the word actually means. It's not abstract. I don't have a cold intellectual relationship with the word anymore. I live with it more often, not all the time, not as much as I'd like, but I'm able to live more in that space. Life is more alive, it's more real when you can inhabit that kind of space. So one other part of Sri Ratna that continues to have a massive impact on me, of Buddhist life, is meditation. And I think others that know me as well, that knew me before I became a Buddhist, would all say that it has seriously changed who I am from an angry person who didn't really give a monkeys about anyone else. I'm a bit of a different bloke. still a mess in progress, but still I am a different person. And to me, meditation, it's hard to talk about in a sense. It's there's kind of a magic, a realness, a clarity in meditation that never ceases to delight, but also to challenge. It's incredibly challenging. And it's difficult for me to imagine life without meditating. Even if there are days when I can only grab a few minutes here or there, sit in my car in the car park and meditate for 5 or 10 minutes, it's still important to have that context, that contact. You know, it's not just an adventure, it's also a great teacher. When we sat earlier on this morning and we had this torrent of thoughts coming through our mind, it brings us into direct contact with what's really going on. We take the time to sit still and just notice what's going on. You know, we're so busy in our lives with all of our everyday activities, we don't often take the time just to notice what is really going on for me. Meditation can put you into that context. And to me, meditation is about cultivating the qualities that we have the potential for, but perhaps we often leave undeveloped. So qualities of kindness, mindfulness, openness, happiness, all these great qualities that we have bucket loads of potential to develop and explore and utilize those for ourselves and for others. But it really helps to cultivate those qualities. It's a way to become fully present, to cease being a bystander, simply observing our lives. And we can become an active participant instead. One thing that Sangharakshita reminds us of again and again is that if we're living life with questionable ethics, then we cannot expect to sit on our cushion or chair and suddenly find ourselves without any sense desires or unwholesome mental states. If we're living life with questionable ethics, when you sit to meditate, you'll know about it. You will know about it. So ethics are vital. And Buddhist ethics are mainly an ethics of intention. Intention being a key piece of karma that people don't often talk about. Karma literally meaning action. But before we do anything, before an action happens, you have to intend it to happen. You have an impulse. So chetana, the Pali word, literally means intention or impulse. Before you do something, you have an intention to do it. We were doing this in study this week. So ethics are vital. So we can't just expect meditation, oh, I sit and meditate for a few years, I'll be kind of cool, people will think I'm trendy and I'll be a calm kind of person. No, you won't. You might have a few moments when you feel more peaceful or more calm, but unless you're transforming all your being, all of how you operate, not just when you're here on the cushion, but when you're living your whole life, unless you really question your ethics, your responses, then that change will be more difficult than you think. So meditation can move us beyond concepts to the truth of our experience. It reveals what's really going on, not just in our mind, but in our body. Body and mind are not separate. You can't have one without the other. It lays bare our true intentions, precursor to karma. Lays bare our true intentions. And our intentions shape the world we experience. So as Sangharakshita says, we have to take responsibility. Not just for the actions, but for the intentions behind the actions. And Dharma itself, all the teachings of the Buddha, it's not just some ancient text just to be studied and put to one side. Dharma is meant to be lived. It's something we live from, something we live with, something we want to aspire towards. It's revolutionary. To me, it's really important to live intimately with that permanently in my mind. It's vital to allow it to permeate my whole being, to feel it, to know the truth. As Sangharakshita said in a quote earlier on, get back to basics. Keep going back to the stuff you think you understand. Reflect on core dharma, such as the lakshanas, shall we say, the marks of existence, the truth that all things are impermanent, impersonal and unsatisfactory. Reflect on those simple Buddhist truths. And those truths, for example, those lakshanas, could be hard to bear. They might even seem depressing. Things are impermanent, impersonal and pretty nasty. You might find that quite difficult. But if you look at impermanence as an example, you know, impermanence reveals a liberation potential. Things are not always going to stay the same. Things will change. You will change. You can change things. We always have a choice, an opportunity. Because everything changes, we can change. We can choose to respond rather than to react. So some of these words that we have in Buddhist circles, impermanence, if we just take a word and look at it for 5 minutes, it can make a big difference. And we can learn from our problems. Our problems can give us energy, hopefully give us a bit of wisdom. Hopefully we can have some deeper realisation. We can crack open our perspective, even just a little, and just kind of change how we perceive things, how we behave in our life. So problems can transform a negative experience into a positive one, if we allow them to. It's our choice, nobody else's. So problems are an opportunity to learn, to step into the reality of our experience and see the bigger picture. And I remember one of the early lectures that I was listening to from Sangharakshita, and he was talking about Vedana and Tanha, again more Buddhist words. So Vedana would translate as feelings, Tanha as craving. And one of the things that Sangharakshita reminds us is, got a real opportunity, just going back to what I was saying, an opportunity. When a feeling arises, that can be very closely followed by craving. But we've got an opportunity to step into that gap and make a decision, make a choice, redirect the intention. So we feel something, before that feeling turns into a craving, I must, I wish, da da da, you've got an opportunity in that space to change direction. We can intervene, that point between feeling and craving, we can intervene. We can break our reactive responses, we can move from reactivity to activity. We can move to responsiveness, to choice. So I really value the way that Sangharakshita has looked at certain words, Buddhist principles, and to put them in some quite complex ways, but also in some quite simple ways. So feeling arises, clock it, make a decision to do something different. Don't react, respond. Turn off the autopilot. Live life more fully. So the last area that I'm going to briefly mention, very briefly, is puja. So I mentioned, to me it's more accurately translated as devotional attention. And I love hard-hitting pujas, as some of you may know. I love a puja that shapes your being with body, speech and mind. It's us in our totality. When all of us is fully engaged, quivering with energy. That's the puja that rocks for me. And as Sangharakshita says, if you leave out devotion, you are closing the door on any emotional engagement with your spiritual ideal. So thank you, Bhante. My simple words can't really do justice to all that he's brought into my life, to the transformation that is still ongoing. And for those of you that wish, I would just like us to end with the White Tower mantra for long life and wisdom and for merit, for those of you that know the text. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Bhante Aya Punyan Yana Pushtin Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Bhante Aya Punyan Yana Pushtin Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Bhante Aya Punyan Yana Pushtin Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Bhante Aya Punyan Yana Pushtin Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture
Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha. Om Tare Tutare Ture Ante Aya Abhinyan Jnana Pushtim Kuru Swaha.
A mantra for long life, wisdom, and merit. Thank you, Bhante.
Thank
you all. So we've reached 1 o'clock, but if there are any questions, if people have them.
Could you repeat that one sentence you said that stays with you all the time?
Yeah, not from memory. Not anymore. Not after talking about that. Yeah, I can. The technology doesn't fail me. So. Ordination is essentially about going to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha for refuge. It's about taking the Buddha and his teaching as your point of reference in everything you say, think, and do. Page 206 in the Yogi's Joy.
In the what?
Yogi's Joy.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.